order because we don't have a quorum. But I do ask for some decorum as we begin the testimony of Mr. Nobles, who is here to give a auditor's report, I'm going to presume, since I just got in the room, on the Minnesota Board of Nursing complaint resolution process.
Mr. Chair, first, were you looking at me or Representative Grunhagen when you said that?
Said what?
Representative Corum?
Both of you.
I'll let that
go. Both of you, thank you. Yeah, we're not really officially, so we could actually use first names right now because we didn't really even officially start. So, Mr. Nobles. Would you like to begin your testimony?
Mr. Chairman, I would, and I appreciate this opportunity to be with you again. It seems like we're here fairly frequently, and we appreciate that. We appreciate you making the time for us to present this report today. As I begin, Mr. Chairman, I just have to let you know that I may have to leave a little bit early. We're releasing a second report over in the Senate, and some of you actually may be interested in that report as well. It concerns a university clinical drug study in the Department of Psychiatry that created some controversy because one of the patients in that study some years ago committed suicide. And it's been a controversial issue for quite a long period of time. And so we were asked to do an investigation, and that report is going to be released. But we are here with you today to talk about the Board of Nursing. And we, from time to time, have looked at the licensing boards for various medical practitioners, and I think it's a very important and very challenging part of what the state does. Because there is, as I think we know, a strong property interest when somebody has a license to practice a profession. And there are, however, a considerable number of complaints against practitioners. And the Board of Nursing has a process, and it necessarily is quite a complicated legal process, to take in those complaints and process them and make a resolution. So Joe Voss, who was the manager of this evaluation, is going to make a presentation of our findings and our recommendations. And so again, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for this opportunity. And if you see me duck out a little early, please take no offense. Although you could, because I'm going over to the Senate.
Mr. Nobles, we do take offense to that. But we are in good hands with Ms. Voss. We worked with her before. She actually probably is an improvement on you anyway. So.
That's correct.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jill Voss, and I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. I also want to introduce KJ Starr and Will Harrison, who also worked on this evaluation with me. This evaluation focused on the reasonableness, the timeliness, the consistency, and the fairness of the Board of Nursing's decisions in resolving complaints. We also looked at the Board's relationship with the Health Professional Services Program, which is an alternative program that monitors nurses as well as other health licensed professionals who have substance abuse or other physical, mental, or psychological problems. Let me start sort of at the bottom line. Overall, we found that the board's decisions to discipline nurses or take other actions to resolve complaints have generally been reasonable. That is, decisions have generally been appropriate given the nurses' violations. However, and this is sort of a big however, we think that it's taken the board too long to resolve some complaints, especially when public safety is at risk. We have 23 recommendations, half for the board itself, half for the legislature, that we think will make the complaint resolution process more timely, more consistent, and more fair. And we've listed them all on pages 91 and 92 of our report, but don't worry, I'm only going to hit a few of the key recommendations this afternoon. Let me backtrack a bit and just provide a little bit of basic information.
Excuse me, Ms. Voss, let me backtrack as well.
Okay.
And we have a quorum, so I'll officially call this meeting to order. You may continue.
All right, okay. The first point I'd like to make, and it's an important point to remember, is that not that many nurses have complaints filed against them. There are about 118,000 nurses licensed to practice in Minnesota. Only about 1.5% are the subjects of one or more complaints. That being said, the board receives about 1,800 complaints a year. The largest group of complaints involved practice-related problems. For example, nurses not documenting correctly or providing, making treatment mistakes or practicing beyond their scope. The second largest group of complaints allege nurse impairment due to alcohol, drugs, or other physical or mental problems. In fiscal year 2014, the board took about 1,800 actions to resolve complaints. Most of the complaints, the overwhelming majority, are resolved internally. Very few complaints end up at the Office of Administrative Hearing. A key feature of the board's internal complaint resolution process is the discipline conference. Discipline conferences are run by review panels that consist of one board member and one staff member. An assistant attorney general also is also at the discipline conferences. These discipline conferences serve a couple of purposes. First of all, nurses get a chance to tell their side of the story to a board member or to the nursing board staff. Also, because it's the board's practice not to talk with nurses about complaints beforehand, this is the first opportunity that staff have to actually talk to nurses about the subject of about a complaint. Prior to this, the board staff collect a lot of records and documents and do those sorts of reviews. The ultimate goal of the discipline conference is to hammer out some sort of agreement. Agreements are then sent on to the full board for its approval. We found that the full board seldom questions review panel recommendations, and it almost always approves the agreements that are worked out in discipline conferences. State law lays out three different types of actions the board can take to resolve complaints. The kind of action the board takes dictates the extent to which information is public. When the board dismisses a complaint, all information about the complaint is considered not public. Only the staff, the complainant, and the nurse, his or herself, know that a complaint was filed and what happened. However, the board keeps the information forever so that if another complaint comes in against the nurse, they can and do reopen formerly dismissed complaints. When the board takes disciplinary action against the nurse, the board issues a final order that is public information. The board posts the information online so that it's readily accessible to everyone. This information is also reported to national databases. The extent to which non-disciplinary actions are public varies. Some of these actions are reported to national databases, some are available on the state's website, and some are not posted anywhere. Once the board posts information to its website, it stays there forever. Okay, so the first area that we looked at was reasonableness. And as I said previously, we think that board actions have generally been reasonable. That being said, the board dismisses most complaints. In 2014, 72% of the complaint resolutions the board made resulted in dismissals. Now, when we first saw this number of 72%, we thought, wow, that looks kind of high. What's going on here? Well, we looked at over 300 complaint files in the Board of Nursing and also in the Health Professional Services Program. And what we found was that there are legitimate reasons why this number is so high. In other words, these dismissals were reasonable. About 24% of complaint resolutions involve some type of discipline. In terms of discipline, the board comes out, we didn't think the board was soft. 43% of all disciplinary actions taken by the board in 2014 involves suspending nurses. Again, these decisions to suspend nurses, as well as the board's decisions to do something other than suspend, seemed appropriate to us. In all of the over 300 files that we looked at, we found only one instance where we sort of kind of sat back and looked at one another and said, you know, wow, how did they come up with this solution? Timeliness. The board has generally met the statutory requirement that complaints be resolved within 1 year of receipt. In 2014, it took the board about 135 days on average to resolve complaints. It took a little less, 107 days to dismiss a complaint, and a little, well, quite a bit more, 218 days on average to take some other action. We think that it's taken the board too long to suspend nurses when public safety is at risk. In 2014, it took the board, on average, 258 days, which is somewhere in the area of 8 to 9 months, to suspend a nurse. This is troubling because nurses can generally work while a complaint is being resolved. And even if a nurse isn't working, there is nothing on that nurse's public record to indicate that there might be a problem. So that prospective employers doing due diligence, checking up on an applicant, wouldn't know anything is wrong if they checked the Board of Nursing's records. We also looked at the extent to which the board has used its authority to issue temporary suspensions. These are reserved for situations where a nurse's continued practice would present an immediate and a serious risk to the public. In these cases, the board can suspend immediately and hold a hearing a little later after the suspension. We found that the board has rarely used its authority to temporarily suspend nurses. Over the last six fiscal years, the board temporarily suspended nurses only 11 times. Now, to the board's credit, seven of those 11 times did occur in fiscal 2014, so they have been using it more in the last year. But even when the board did use this authority, it didn't exactly move swiftly. Only once did the board suspend a nurse within 1 month of getting a complaint. Five of the 11 temporary suspensions took longer than 4 months to issue. And again, these nurses were free to practice while the complaint was being resolved. We identified several instances in our report where we thought the board could have and should have acted faster than they did. We also looked at the consistency of the board's complaint resolutions. And by consistency, we mean that similar complaints are resolved in a similar manner. And in this area, we sort of have good news and sort of not quite as good of news. On the positive side, we found that the board's actions were very consistent when it came to suspending, when it came to dealing with nurses who admitted diverting drugs. Although the board doesn't have any official written policy in this regard, it almost always suspended nurses for at least 1 year when they've been accused of drug diversion. On the not quite as positive side, we found that the board was inconsistent in resolving some practice complaints when public safety was less of an issue. And we looked at consistency here in two different ways. First of all, we examined all complaints heard in discipline conferences in terms of whether they were dismissed or not. And we found that complaints were much more likely to be dismissed when board members who were nurses, as opposed to board members who were public members, served on those discipline review panels. We also found that the board sometimes used lower level sanctions to resolve similar complaints interchangeably. For example, complaints were sometimes dismissed, other times resulted in low-level disciplinary action like a fine or a letter of reprimand, or sometimes resulted in non-disciplinary action such as an agreement for corrective action. While any of those actions might have been reasonable, there appeared to be little rhyme or reason why one option was chosen over another. I think part of the problem has to do with the fact that the board has few tools to help board members decide what are the appropriate actions we should take in certain types of violations. We also looked at fairness, and we found that the process wasn't always fair to nurses. First of all, everything is very legalistic. Not only are all the documents that are sent to nurses written in legalese or legal language, but discipline conferences are also very legal. most nurses do not hire attorneys to help them sort of get through the complaint resolution process. And we just thought that the board could do more, with little effort on their part, I think, could do more to make an already daunting experience a little more understandable to the nurse. This would be in keeping with Governor Dayton's 2014 executive order, which said that state agencies, when dealing with the public, should conduct business in plain English. We also thought that state law was a little unduly harsh in making all disciplinary and most non-disciplinary actions public information forever. Given the inconsistencies we found in terms of the board's decisions in some types of complaints, we don't think this is really fair to nurses, nor does it contribute greatly to increasing public safety. We also thought it was unfair that there was no way for nurses to gracefully, I guess is the best way to put it, gracefully give up their licenses when their health made it impossible for them to practice safely. The only recourse the board has in these instances is to take disciplinary action against the nurse to remove the license, even though the nurse has done absolutely nothing wrong. Now, some other health licensing boards deal with these situations in a slightly different way. They're able to grant emeritus status to people under these circumstances, and we think the board should be exploring this type of having this type of tool available to them. We also looked at the board's working relationship with the Health Professional Service Program, or HPSP. People get into HPSP in two ways. They are referred there by one of the health-related licensing boards. The program also accepts nurses and other licensed professionals who refer themselves to the program or are referred there by third parties. In these latter situations, the Board of Nursing may not know that a nurse is in the program or that a nurse has a problem that might affect his or her practice. HPSP monitors licensees with substance abuse or other physical or mental problems to ensure that they can practice safely. It is not a treatment program, though, although treatment is a large part of the nurses agreeing to go into the program. Most of the nurses in HPSP, 79%, have an alcohol or drug problem. 54%, in addition to having an alcohol or drug problem, also have a medical or a psychiatric condition. We noted during our evaluation, and I think the Board of Nursing would agree with us, that HPSP is a very difficult program to successfully complete. Nurses have to sign participation agreements that generally require a 3 to 5 year commitment. Page 76 in our full report, we show a typical monitoring agreement, and if you look at that or have time to look at it later, you'll see that it's quite extensive. For example, if you have a substance abuse problem and you're in HPSP, you have to call a tox line every single day to find out if you have to go in for a tox screening that day. The Board of Nursing uses HPSP more than any other licensing board, which probably isn't surprising given the large numbers of nurses. We looked at the percentage of nurses successfully completing HPSP over the last 4 years. We found that 48% of the nurses successfully completed the program, compared with a 59% success rate for other health licensed professionals. And we asked the Board of Nursing staff and we asked HPSP staff why nurses have a lower success rate. We were told that the Board of Nursing expects HPSP to discharge nurses whenever they don't comply with program requirements, and that other health licensing boards are more likely to ask HPSP to keep the licensed professional in the program. Another reason nurses don't do as well has to do with costs. Although nurses do not have to pay for the cost of actually being monitored, they do have to pay for their tox screens. They have to pay for their treatment, so it's not a cheap program, especially if you aren't working. We identified two major sources of conflict regarding the Board of Nursing's relationship with HPSB, and the first has to do with the confidentiality of nurses in the program. In theory, the Board of Nursing has no knowledge about nurses who self-refer to the program or are referred there by third parties. About half of the nurses who participate in HPSB are third-party referrals or self-referrals. The Board of Nursing will only learn about these nurses if HPSB reports them for non-compliance or discharges them from the program for any reason other than successful completion. The problem is about with this confidentiality revolves around public safety and how each of the agencies view their role. The Board of Nursing says, rightly so, that how do you expect us to protect the public and investigate a complaint, investigate a complaint against the nurse if we don't even know they're in this program? The HPSB people will say, rightfully so, public safety would suffer if these nurses knew upon enrollment that they were going to be reported to the board. They wouldn't enroll in the program in the first place. Both sides, there's merit to both sides of the argument. So we decided, well, we're going to look to see how big is this problem. First of all, over half of the nurses who self-refer or are referred there by third parties eventually come to the board's attention because they haven't complied with HPSB requirements. They get reported. We looked at the nurses who then, in theory, the board didn't know were in HPSB. We found that 17% of these nurses who successfully completed the program over the last 4 years had complaints filed against them with the Board of Nursing while they were in HPSB, and the board likely did not know they were in the program. 23% of the nurses who successfully completed HPSB back in 2000 through 2004, who the board didn't know were in the program, later had complaints filed against them after they got out of the program. And again, these are nurses that the board likely didn't know participated in HPSB. While these numbers, 17-23%, aren't huge, they're not an insignificant number of nurses either. The second issue of concern has to do with just basic philosophical differences between the two programs. As I alluded to before, the Board of Nursing and HPSB each approach the public safety aspect of the work from a slightly different angle. Neither side is wrong. HPSB has developed one set of policies to cover all 17 health licensing boards. The board would argue, and we would agree, that nurses present unique risks to the public that some other health licensed professionals do not. For example, few other health professionals have access to patients' homes or access to narcotic drugs the way that nurses do. Few other health professionals are as responsible for the day-to-day care or even the minute-to-minute care of vulnerable people that nurses are. HPSB's policies do not take these factors into consideration. So, what do we do about all of this? Well, we have a lot of recommendations, but here are some of our key ones. First of all, we think the legislature should give board staff greater authority to investigate complaints. Currently, staff don't think they can investigate complaints, that is, talk to nurses outside of discipline conferences. We also think the legislature should give the board staff greater authority to dismiss complaints. Current law requires the board to have two board members sign off on all dismissals. Given the large number of dismissals and the nature of a lot of those dismissals, we think this might be overkill. We think the legislature should give the Board of Nursing the authority to expunge certain information from nurses' public records when appropriate. The information would remain available to the Board of Nursing. We think the legislature should give the Board of Nursing the ability to issue emeritus licenses to allow some nurses to retire a little more gracefully. Regarding the confidentiality issue in HPSB, we think we have a very practical solution to the problem. We think the legislature should require the Board of Nursing to send a list of nurses who have complaints filed against them over to HPSP, where staff would more or less say to the board, yep, nurse number three, she's here, nurse number two, he's here, and so on.
Ms. Boss? Yeah, pardon me, but we have a question from a member.
Oh, okay.
It's actually me.
Oh, okay.
question regarding, just go back of their legislative action, and will you suggest that to reduce some of the workload that the board staff perhaps could dismiss some of the complaints themselves. Now, wouldn't they be then taking the place for the board? Why would you have the staff, or maybe the staff is expert opinion as to why they should dismiss some of the complaints and not the board? Because the board, of course, is there to adhere to the complaints. So why ask us to require the staff to do their work?
Mr. Chair, one of the things that we noticed when we were doing the evaluation is that board members really work hard. They spend a lot of time going through very serious complaints, and they spend a lot of time going through complaints that aren't as serious. We think that there's room here. The Board of Nursing staff are very, very capable people. We were impressed with the quality of work they do. They would come into the discipline conferences with stacks of information. We think they're very qualified. We think that there are mechanisms the board could use. For example, they could routinely audit, routinely look at some of the dismissals, a random sample, just to make sure that the board was, that staff were dismissing the ones they felt were, that their dismissals were appropriate. We also think there's room for the Board of Nursing to develop some guidelines in this area, saying staff can routinely dismiss these types of complaints. These types of complaints we're going to require, continue to require board members to dismiss. Part of it is an effort to make, to allow board members themselves to focus more of their attention on the more serious complaints. And it would require a legislative change.
Thank you, Ms. Voss. Okay. So that would allow, if there's a complaint, then the board has to be notified, then they have to convene for a meeting. Is that correct?
It depends, Mr. Chair. It depends on the nature of the complaint. Not all complaints would go into a discipline conference. Some are settled without that. The board would ultimately see the final product, though.
So the staff could say, have a complaint that, hey, I don't like the way the nurse smiled at me today. I wouldn't have to, they could dismiss that without having the board, then. Is that kind of the
minutia
of that?
Yes, they could dismiss those sorts of complaints. And those are the very, they get a lot of complaints that are not very serious that they dismiss.
Yeah, we humans do complain a lot, don't we? It's in our nature, unfortunately.
Not that much if the board only gets 800 a year, though, I guess.
The only 1.5% complaints.
Only 1.5%.
That shows the nurses are really doing great work.
And we did want to emphasize that it's a very small percentage of nurses who are complained about. We also do have recommendations for the board. First of all, we think the board should make greater and quicker use of its ability to temporarily suspend nurses. We think that the board should give staff greater authority to propose settlements in cases where violations do not pose or present a serious risk to the public. We think the board should be developing administrative rules or guidelines to help board members determine appropriate actions for certain kinds of violations. And in the report, we point out a number of areas where we think that there's room for the board to develop a lot more guidance. Finally, we think that the Board of Nursing and HPSB need to work together to develop nurse-specific policies regarding nurses in the Health Professional Services Program. And that is our report in a nutshell.
Thank you, Ms. Voss. We do have a question for another member, Representative Allen. Is that correct?
No.
Oh, sorry. No? I thought that's what he said. Okay, members, any questions for Ms. Voss? Representative who? Oh, of course. Representative Grunhagen has a question.
Thank Sorry. You, Mr. Chair.
Sorry, Glenn.
Well, I think, but anyway, the thank you for the testimony. Thank you for your excellent work, and I just find the Office of the Legislative Auditor to constantly do a above average job in whatever task they undertake. The clarification I just want is. Does your office, you know, there's legislative recommendations and board recommendations. Okay, you've got other things that point out some problems in these areas and in other reports you've given. Do you just give those, you know, as far as legislative, obviously that's up to us, okay, initiate legislation or changes is my understanding. But on some of these other board recommendations, do you have any enforcement authority or are these just recommendations you give to the board and say we hope you follow these, you know, if you want to respond to that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunhagen, we have no enforcement authority. So whoever we make the recommendation to, whether it's an administrative agency or the legislature, they have to take that action. But I would say that our experience with agencies and the recommendations we give them is that they take them very seriously. And, you know, what we recognize, though, is that it's probably more important that they recognize that there's an issue and a problem. And as we think about a solution, there may be several different ways. And so the important thing is that they find a way to solve the problem. And it may be a little bit different than what we recommended. Periodically, we do like to go back into organizations and do some follow-up work and see whether they have corrected the problem or not. But specifically to your question, no, we don't have enforcement authority.
Representative Grunhagen?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. The other question, and I don't know if you have this information, how does our complaint resolution system and number of complaints compare to the five-state area or a number of states? I mean, are we average? Are we below average? Are we, you know, are we... do we have a process that's efficient and brings good results, or did you find any comparative Board of Nursing states where they were doing a better job more efficiently and bringing about a quicker resolution on some of these?
Ms. Voss.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen. We do not do an extensive analysis of how other states do it. There's so much variation in terms of how other states organize their nursing boards, the amount of authority that nursing boards have. So we do not compare Minnesota directly to any of the other neighboring states in terms of complaints or resolutions.
Representative Grunhagen? We have another question, but I'm going to just ask a quick question. I noticed in your findings, the complaint resolution process is not always fair to nurses, and that participating in a discipline conference is the only time the nurses have to directly talk to. Mm-hmm. How quickly are they brought into the complaint? For example, someone parks down in the parking stall, and they park kittywampus, so I can never get my car right in, and I'm going to go right to that person to complain to them before I go up higher. Do the nurses have an opportunity to hear their complaints, what's about them, first?
Mr. Chair, the board will send out at some point a notice to the nurse that there has been a complaint received, and they will invite the nurse to come to a discipline conference if they're having one. They usually give them, you know, 20 or 30 days notice so they can prepare for it. We looked at complaints that how long it took to resolve complaints when they had a discipline conference and when they didn't have a discipline conference, if the board was going to take some kind of disciplinary action. We found that those complaints resolved with discipline conferences took on average 100 days longer to resolve than those that didn't go through the discipline conference process. So it adds time, but you know, sometimes nurses will reschedule and it does add time to the process, but it does add a level of fairness, I guess, if a nurse wants to come in and meet with the staff.
Thank you, Ms. Voss. Our resident nurse, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of questions, and thank you for the report. I'm wondering, and my questions have really to do with the relationship between the board and HPSP and then how nurses are coming through that process, mm-hmm. right? And I recall early in my career when the licensing board, I think together, decided to create HPSP and to fund that as a way to make sure that health professionals who were struggling with chemical addiction or substance abuse were able to find their way into treatment. Mm-hmm. And I think it, on balance, has proven successful, although it has always been, in my professional career, a difficult issue, especially with providers, not just nurses, but all providers who find themselves in clinical practice and using and trying to make sure the Board of Nursing is doing its job to protect the public and the mutual goal, often the employer's goal, the individual's goal. And in some cases, well, the Board of Nursing has the job of protecting the public, so they probably don't share this goal. But, you know, we want to make sure that those providers, nurses, doctors, et cetera, mm-hmm. find their way into treatment and back to clinical practice if they're clean. And I have some personal experience with this with a family member, and I know what a treacherous journey it can be. And it can be really threatening to a clinical license. So in your recommendations, you suggest that the Board of Nursing work with HPSB to develop nurse-specific policies and procedures. And I'm wondering if you could expound on that a little bit. And my area of questioning is not just about what you think falls in that bucket, but then also how does that comport with your thinking about HPSP and other disciplines, other licensed professionals who are also interacting or interfacing with HPSP. So how do the physicians do it, and what is your, did you explore how they are interacting with HPSP or what that looks like with the Board of Medical Practice versus the Board of Nursing? So I'm just wondering how the other disciplines are being considered, and if you're seeing best practices in with the other licensing boards that maybe would inform the Board of Nursing. I know that's a long question.
Ms. Voss.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we only looked at the relationship between the Board of Nursing and HPSB. We didn't have time to actually look how other health-related boards deal with HPSB. We do realize that it's when a nurse enters HPSB, it's difficult to even refer oneself to the program, and it's a difficult program to complete. I think we recognize that, and so does the Board of Nursing. Our recommendation, first of all, our first recommendation would be that the board sends over a list of nurses and HPSB tells them which ones are in the program. We don't think it's necessary for the Board of Nursing to know about everybody in the program unless they're having a problem in the Board of Nursing, unless they have a complaint against them. We think that there's room for more nurse-specific nurse-specific approaches to things. Boards use the HPSP in different ways. A lot of the health licensing boards will refer people over to HPSP when they get a criminal background check that shows somebody had a DWI. They will refer that person to be assessed for chemical dependency. The Board of Nursing sends more people to HPSB under discipline than most of the other health licensing boards do. They are less likely to make a non-disciplinary referral to the program. So they use the program a lot differently. And as we said, nurses typically have different contact with vulnerable people. We think there's room for having policies related to what sorts of practice issues should be reported to the board and what sorts of practice issues are not to be reported. Right now, if a HPSB learns of a practice issue and they determine that it's related to one's illness, they don't have to tell the State Board of Nursing about it. We think that there are some policies and practices that the boards could work out, the Board of Nursing and HPSB could work out. For example, we think that the board could hire a nurse under contract to audit HPSC files occasionally, just to make sure that, yeah, they seem to be doing what we think they should be doing in terms of how we want nurses treated in the program. I think there's just a lot of room for misunderstanding between the two programs. I'm not sure if that actually got to your point.
Well, thank you. And Mr.
Representative.
Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. If we were to make some law changes to direct the Board of Nursing HPSP to engage in this work, is there an argument to be made that we should apply that then to all the licensed professionals that are participating in HPSP in terms of auditing or sending names either to the licensing board or to HPSP to, it sounds a little like check in on the progress of the provider, mm-hmm. the progress of the licensee who is going through treatment. And I'm just wondering if that is the right public policy for one group of licensed professionals, mm-hmm. then should we think about that for all the licensed professionals?
Ms. Voss.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. I personally don't know, and we did not look at the relationship that the other health licensing boards have with HPSB. When we did look at the Board of Nursing, we felt that there was a great deal of sort of distrust between the two groups. And we made some recommendations that we felt would sort of get them working together more, develop more of a relationship where they would trust that the other is doing what they think they should be doing. I can't speculate, I guess, as to how other health licensing boards should be treated.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you think that part of your recommendation really is about the relationship between the board and HPSP and not so much about the licensees? Is that accurate?
Ms. Voss.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I do think it's more about how do you go about regulating or ensuring public safety. And I think our own numbers show that there are nurses who are in HPSP successfully completing the program that the board doesn't know about, that maybe they should know they're in HPSP when there's a complaint filed against them. We don't think they need to know about people who are doing okay. HPSP is doing a good job monitoring the licensees. We have no concerns about that. We just think that there is another element to it when the board is trying to investigate and they don't have all of the information they should have.
Representative Murphy?
Yeah, thank you, Mr.
Also,
Chair.
I have one more other point that HPSP, there's about 500 people in the program a year. Half of those are nurses. And so the Board of Nursing is the big user of HPSP. And they pay for most of HPSP's costs.
Yeah, and thanks, Mr. Chair. And I bet that's because there are so many more nurses.
Well, there are.
Right,
yes.
And there are the other licensed providers. I'm wondering if you have contemplated, thank you, Mr. Chair, the sort of the basic premise around HPSP when it was created was that notion of licensees self-reporting, mm-hmm. Making a self-referral, and choosing a path into treatment. Versus discipline. And if you've considered that along with your recommendation about this sort of sharing of lists mm-hmm. in certain circumstances and what that might do to provide who finds himself in that situation of using and maybe hiding that and trying to avoid that rather than going into self-referral for fear that they will end up before the licensing board and in a disciplinary situation where they could lose their license and thus their job. So avoiding treatment because they want to keep their job.
Ms. Voss.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. People who, when they self-refer, they know right away when they sign up for the program that if they fail in the program, if they don't comply, they're going to be reported. They sign up anyway.
Mm-hmm.
We're only interested in having those people who self-refer who have a complaint filed against them over in the Board of Nursing. Those are the only group of people that we think the board should know about. And so there is an active investigation going on. The board, I think we trust the board staff well enough to know that if it's relevant, they'll use that information. If it's not relevant, they're not going to. I think that people, when they sign up, they know that there are certain instances where, and it's, there are a lot more instances where you get reported to the board than when you don't. I mean, yeah.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for taking my questions. I appreciate it, and I think at least I'll speak for myself, and I would imagine this is true for my colleagues as well, is that we want a healthy workforce of health professionals. And, you know, if it were an ideal world, people who find themselves in this situation would get treatment, and the public would be protected. That's the ideal world, and I think that's, you know, certainly my public policy aim. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to make sure I understood the recommendations so I can think about those in that context. Thank you.
You're welcome. I mean, not you're welcome. Very good, Representative Murphy. Well, before we move on to our next testifier, the Board of Nursing would like to report on the findings and give their opinion. So we have Shirley Brecken for the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Nursing. But I was informed just now, pardon me, would you, we have a question from Representative Liebling, so I jumped the gun.
Okay.
Sorry, Representative Hamilton and Liebling, how rude of me. Representative Hamilton's first.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I tell you what, this is an eye-opener for me as a patient, and why so? First of all, give a shout-out to the nurses that I work with. They're fantastic, right? And when you were talking about if there's a complaint filed or a complaint against a nurse, that they would have X amount of time to prepare for that and then be brought in, that would be extremely intimidating, right? Extremely intimidating. And the nurses that I've worked with, like I said, are fantastic, extremely professional, by the book, etc. The patient's not so much all the time, right? And so how would you be able to cut through what's real and what isn't, if you will, not to put a nurse through all that. Does that make sense, that question? Because I can see a person having a bad day, grumpy, whatever, you're going in there, and all of a sudden you're complaining about everything. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily reflects on the nurse. However, since a complaint has been brought up, do we have to subject the nurse through all that? Is there a way that you could cut through and make sure that it actually has merit, if that makes sense for a question?
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Great question. Ms. Voss.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, the Board of Nursing staff, when they first get a complaint, they look at it to see, well, is this even a violation of the Nurse Practice Act? So anybody who's complaining about a grumpy nurse or somebody who was, you know, didn't treat them, you know, smile, they dismiss that. That's not something they would investigate. We do think that it is a daunting experience. We sat in on a large number of discipline conferences, and it's a daunting experience for a nurse to come in and have to explain his or her actions and everything. And we think we made a number of recommendations that we think could help that situation. First of all, we think that if staff had greater authority to investigate complaints, meaning actually talk to nurses, they wouldn't need to always bring them in for discipline conferences. If you just call up and say, what happened, talk one-on-one, they may be able to settle something without having to bring the nurse in and put her or his through the process. Also, that's sort of the genesis of our recommendation that things should be more in plain English when nurses come in, to make the experience less daunting so that they understand what's happening, so that they understand when they come into this that something is probably going to result, that conference will result in some sort of resolution probably, and you could lose your license, you may not. Explaining that in plain English, I think, would help also.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure if you went here in your study or investigation, but to the complaints themselves, was there a common denominator around complaints filed, like the type of work or responsibility around them, the amount of training, the years of experience, the amount of supervision, anything like that? I mean, is there something that we could be focusing on that would trigger complaints, if you will?
Ms. Voss.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, that's a very interesting question, and no, we did not you know, sort of do a what, you know, a look at the relationship between a complaint and a nurse's background or where she or he went to school. Or we do know from that licensed practical nurses get there are a disproportionately larger share of complaints filed against those nurses than there are against registered nurses. But that's about as far as we took it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a kind of a few little questions here. First of all, I just wanted to kind of go back to the topic of your recommendation about doing something maybe different with nurses in the HPSP process. And I kind of, if I was understanding where Representative Murphy was going with this, I think I am agreeing with her. It's my understanding that HPSP kind of tailors their contract with each person to that person's needs. And so I wonder if it would be really necessary to treat nurses as a group any differently, because some nurses, as we all know, have a great variety of practice settings. And I would think that HPSP would already be, I hope they are, kind of tailoring their monitoring and their requirements to that person's practice setting. So that would, for me, I want to ask you if you're understanding that that's what they do, if you looked at that at all, because, you know, for example, if a nurse is administering narcotics, he or she is, and has a drug abuse problem, you know, there has to be some stopping of that or removal from that practice setting, and I know they do deal with that situation. However, if the person is in a very different practice setting, they may not really have any day-to-day responsibilities administering drugs, for example. So I don't know how fair or useful it is to have different rules for nurses as a profession than for other professionals who also take physicians. Some of them may be, again, dealing with, you know, if you're an anesthesiologist, you're going to be around those drugs all the time, whereas if you're a pediatrician, you're probably not so much. So could you just address that first?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, the monitoring agreements are tailored less to who the licensed professional is, whether it is a doctor or a nurse, but more to the type of problem that the person shows, it a substance abuse problem or a physical health problem. Everybody has a worksite monitor who does monitor the behavior of the licensed professional in the setting. Where we think there's room to have more nurse-specific policies is in terms of how many relapses should a professional have before they're reported to the licensing board, or what sorts of practice issues should the HPSB routinely tell the board about? Is if somebody is perennial is late for work, is that the sort of thing that the HPSB should tell the Board of Nursing or not? Sometimes it's indicative of a substance abuse problem, sometimes it's not. There just needs to be, I think, a lot more clarification to get the two groups to, I guess, trust one another a lot more. There are a lot of, you know, I might add that there, HPSP does have some unofficial, unwritten policies where they'll call the board and ask for advice, but they won't say the name of the person or anything. And these are unofficial, unwritten policies, but we think that unofficial, unwritten policies should just be put down so that both sides agree that, yes, this is our policy, and it's something written down that both sides can look at and agree to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Voss. And I do want to say, too, I really appreciate all of this. And last year, I did a lot of work with the board, and kind of, some people might remember, there was a whole series of articles in the Strib about problem nurses, and it raised a lot of alarm. And we took what we thought was a pretty deep look at the Board of Nursing, and we did make some changes in law. But we knew that the legislature, it's really hard, especially with the press of other things going on, to really do what you do for us so well. And this gives us a lot to to follow up on, continue to make changes and work with the parties. But a couple of things I wanted to ask you about, though, with that background. One is if you could talk a little bit more about the time lag, which is, I think, one of the biggest concerns that's raised in your report, and it was a concern for us last year. We did make some adjustments to law to try to address that. Obviously, if a nurse has a problem, or any licensed professional, but and in fact, we adjusted the law for all of them, but if somebody has a problem that's a possible impact on public safety, we want to give the board tools to intervene immediately. And apparently they're not doing that so well. And then the second question I have is about the impact of the fact that the board now oversees APRNs, which I think is new since last year. And if you looked at if that has any impact on any of what you're talking about here, or if it's just too new to even enter into any of this.
Ms. Voss.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, let me deal with the second question first, the APRNs. They've always been licensed by the Board of Nursing as registered nurses anyway. And so in terms of their ability to go into HPSP, how well they do, they're registered nurses and they're already included. We don't separate them out as a category at all. In terms of your question about the lag time, we looked at the time elapsing between the HPSP discharging a nurse for because she or he hadn't complied with the program, and the time it took the Board of Nursing to act. And this is on page 84 in our report. We found that on average it took the board 160 days after having a nurse referred to them from the board, from the HPSP, to impose discipline, with a median time of about 142 days. So it took the board 4 months to act, even though a lot of times when HPSP sends over these case files and says, Jane Doe, she flunked out, here's all the evidence you need, it took the board a long time to act. We think that we made a couple of recommendations in that area. We think that that the legislature should allow the board, the HPSP, to continue to monitor those nurses who they discharge and send over, if the nurse is willing. Let HPSP continue to monitor them until the Board of Nursing takes some sort of action. A lot of nurses who are discharged want to continue into the program. They've had a relapse. They haven't complied. We should allow them to remain in that structured environment to help them progress through treatment. We also think it, because the Board of Nursing would be paid for that, it might be a little spur for them to act quicker. We also recommend that the Board of Nursing delegate to staff greater authority to propose settlements in some cases. And this would be a prime case where it would be easy for board staff to come up with a settlement offered to the nurse without having to go through a discipline conference and all the time that it takes to add that element to it. And so we think that there are some recommendations that would address that time lag. But it's troubling because when a nurse is discharged, between the time of discharge and the time the board acts, there's no one monitoring the nurse. The worksite monitor is no longer in the picture. And we just think that there should be something there.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll wrap it up here. But I just, finally, I just, along those same lines, we did change the law. We did, we thought we were giving the board the authority to immediately suspend a person when they had, I forget the exact language, but when they had probable cause to believe there was an immediate risk of harm, and then start the more formal process. But suspending someone's license so that they are not continuing to practice when, evidence shows probable cause is a pretty high standard, that they're creating a risk of harm to the public. And I'm kind of troubled to hear that that's not really being used. And I'm wondering, is that just not workable? I mean, I get that there are other things that make this a long, drawn-out process, but our intent was to give them an immediate tool and have them use it so that the public could be assured that at least once they knew about something, they could act.
Ms. Voss.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, even the board has always had the power to immediately suspend nurses and issue a temporary suspension. So, and we have seen that in fiscal year 2014, they did it 7 times, whereas in the previous 5 years, they only did it 4 times. So they are using that authority more. In terms of the legislation that was passed last session, it really didn't go into effect until July of last year, and most of our data, we sort of had the cutoff point of July 2014. Mm-hmm. So you might want to ask the Board of Nursing if they're using it a lot more. We didn't. Well.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're
Thank
welcome. You, Mr. Chair. Yes, indeed. And Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief. I'm wondering, Ms. Voss, if in your work to create the report, if you've consulted with Hazleton or other experts in substance abuse?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, yes, we did talk with, MetData met with a number of professionals at Hazleton and talked with them extensively about their experience, about treatment, about their opinion, I guess, of the Board of Nursing and HPSP. Yes.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Buss, you mentioned in your answers to Representative Liebling that one of the recommendations or one of the things you think the Board of Nursing and HPSP should consider is number of relapses. And if you think that is a critical factor, again, I think that is something that we might want to consider in terms of HPSP and all the licensed professionals and not just the profession of nursing itself. If we believe that a number of relapses is an indicator of success in substance abuse, and we're concerned about public safety, again, I think that might be something we would want to consider for all the licensed professionals and not just one.
Ms. Voss?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. I guess I don't know whether or not it should be considered in light of all of the professionals. I do know that nurses have... I don't know if this for a fact, but it's probably more likely a nurse will have a relapse because she or he is around drugs so much more than a different kind of health licensed professional, an optometrist doesn't have as many drugs available as nurses do. There's just more opportunity. I don't know if that means that a nurse should have more opportunities to relapse or less opportunities. I think it's something that where there's differences of opinion about practice, I think it needs to be worked out between the two agencies.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Voss, I guess this is where we're going to part ways. Having a clinical practice, I certainly worked with nurses and physicians and pharmacists and many licensed professionals who have access to pharmaceutical agents mm-hmm. all of the time. And as I have consulted with those with expertise in substance abuse and the idea of clinical practice, those with that expertise have suggested to me that for someone to go back into clinical practice means that they can have access and practice clean. And so it is not necessarily the access, but it is the fact that they are successfully managing the condition that is the marker. And I understand the notion of relapse, and we should pay attention to that, but I can't imagine that we could, with a straight face as policymakers, say that a physician or a pharmacist has less access to a pharmaceutical agent drugs. And equally so, people who practice in nursing homes versus hospitals are in the very work that they're doing, handling and using narcotics. And so, maybe not an optometrist, but I think that's the exception and not the rule. Yeah, so I think as a policymaker, again, if the aim is a workforce that is, providing safe, quality care, this is something that we should be paying attention to. But if the best practice or the experience that you're sharing with us or your advice that you're sharing with us about one discipline is the case and it is informed by expertise in substance abuse, then I think we have to consider it more broadly than just for the profession of nursing.
Okay, Representative Murphy, did you want to respond to that, Ms. Voss?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I just wanted to say one thing, that in cases of nurses or other health professionals who have drug problems, HPSP generally requires that they do not administer drugs, that they do not have keys and access to drugs. So that's pretty much a straightforward policy, I believe, of HPSP.
And Mr. Chair, I understand that if I'm correct about this, it is the case while they're going through treatment. But when they are discharged from the program and returned to clinical practice, they are not limited in their access to providing a full range of their professional practice, including administering drugs.
Representative Murphy. Okay, before any other questions at all? All right, then we'll move on to Ms. Brecken from the Board of Nursing, Executive Director from the Minnesota Board of Nursing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have with me today Deborah Hogginson, who is the president of the Minnesota Board of Nursing, and she's going to make a few comments before I share my comments.
Thank you. You may state your name.
Thank you. My name is Deb Hogginson. I live and work in Park Rapids, Minnesota. I'm an RN member of the Minnesota Board of Nursing and currently serving as board president. I'm grateful for the opportunity to represent the Minnesota Board of Nursing in response to the evaluation conducted by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I would like to publicly thank the Office of the Legislative Auditor for their comprehensive evaluation. I was grateful to see that the auditor's overall conclusions that the board's decisions have been reasonable, appropriate, and consistent with the board's mission to protect the public. I also value the audit's recommendations for improvement in the board's discipline process. The thorough evaluation and analysis in the legislative audit provides information that aligns and will support the board's strategic plan. In the board's strategic plan for fiscal years 14 through 16, we identified strategies to support the provision of a fair, consistent, and efficient complaint resolution process. The strategies in our plan included developing a formal evaluation process for complaint resolution, evaluating best practices for case resolution and public protection, analyzing and updating internal procedures, and proposing any needed statutory changes. The board identified a need to use evidence-based strategies to improve the complaint resolution process even before the legislative audit began and was completed. The findings of the audit and the recommendations will help support this work. The mission of the board is to protect the public's health and safety through the regulation of nursing education, licensure, and practice. Members of the Board of Nursing are fully committed to that mission. They're concerned and conscientious and care about carrying out their duties in a responsible manner. Since the audit began, I, along with my fellow board members and board staff, have considered this an opportunity to strengthen the work of the board and ultimately strengthen public protection. The board has scheduled a meeting to thoroughly and thoughtfully review and consider the information, analysis, and recommendations provided by the legislative audit report. So on behalf of the board, I thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and I would now turn to Shirley Brecken, to the executive director of the board, to further provide response to the audit.
Thank you, Ms. Higginson. Ms. Brecken, you may begin with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Shirley Brecken. I am the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Nursing, and I have some prepared remarks, but I thought it would be best if I even answered a couple of the questions that were brought up during the OLA report. Representative Hamilton raised a question regarding, do we know data about nurses in situations of violations of practice or unsafe practice? And I would tell you that for a few years now, the Board of Nursing has been participating in a national study. It's called the TERCAP. It's a taxonomy of error reporting, and we are doing that in conjunction with several other boards of nursing through the National Council of State Boards of Nursing. In situations of violations of the law, we complete a very lengthy survey regarding things such as setting, time of the day, staffing, the type of practitioner, whether it's an LPN, an RN, what the nature of the unsafe practice is. I believe we are one of five states that right now that are contributing that data. I'll take that back. There are other states. We're in the top five of the number of cases that we submit, and we've been engaged in that for some time. So we are looking at that kind of data. We needed to establish a significant database to be able to have for analysis, but I can certainly get the latest report regarding that to you. I'd also like to address, I think it was Representative Murphy who was addressing many issues related to healthy workforce and issues related to chemical dependency with practitioners. Very recently, in this past year, I have been working with representatives from the University of Minnesota and the Fairview Health System, along with an individual from Hazelden and a well-known nurse leader in our community, Marie Manthe, regarding this very issue, especially related to education. And that is, what do we need to do in nursing education programs to help the future nurses be aware of the incidence of a chemical dependence or substance use disorders, and to help them develop a healthy approach to dealing with that. So I wanted to share those couple of things, and there are certainly more that I would be happy to discuss with you. I do want to acknowledge the value of this report. I recall in the initial interview with Mr. Nobles, his comment that often an evaluation will identify issues or opportunities for improvement that an agency has already had some similar idea or indication. And there are instances of that in this review. As Ms. Hawkinson has stated, in the strategic planning, the board identified the need for a fair, consistent, and efficient complaint review process, and to meet this objective was actually engaged in the development of a formal evaluation of the complaint review process. However, when we were notified of the evaluation to be conducted by the Office of the Legislative Auditor, the board put that on hold to wait for the efforts and outcomes of this review by the auditor. I can assure you that the report that was done by Ms. Voss and her group far exceed the resources the board would have had to conduct such a comprehensive evaluation report. So this report is really providing us with some very helpful information. I can tell you that, you know, statistically, the young man that helped them with do their analysis, I did try to, recruit him away from the auditor's office. Unfortunately, they respectfully declined that. I appreciate that you've just received this report, and it's very lengthy. And I know you've not had the sufficient time to digest its contents. But the executive summary, as was presented by Ms. Voss, really gives you some key findings and recommendations. I would also share with you that additionally, the board itself has not had the ample opportunity to review the content in this report. However, both the board and staff are committed to a review of the content and recommendations. And I would also be happy to meet with any one of you, any member of this committee, and others to discuss the content, the consideration of recommendations, and describe the progress of the board as it works through all of this. The board and staff view the findings and recommendations as one of quality improvement. What I'd like to do for you this afternoon, though, is just hit some of the high points and some of the low points. Some of these findings validate the board's knowledge. Some provide greater detail for analysis, and others, as often is the case, describe the instances that merit more detailed research and analysis at a more granular level so as to have a greater understanding of the basis for the finding and determine appropriate solutions, not only fixes. The report describes the complaint resolution process in detail, so I'm not going to go through that with you, and I know that Ms. Voss shared much of that with you too. She also shared with you that the board, the evaluation was conducted looking at reasonableness, timeliness, consistency, and fairness. And you may recall that the impetus for this was a series of newspaper articles in late 2013 that suggested that the board's disciplinary actions were insufficient to protect the public from impaired nurses. The articles explicated situations in which nurses were allowed to return to practice after their license had been suspended, or instances in which the board dismissed the matter when there was a perception of public risk or harm. The board appreciates findings that overall the evaluators concluded the board's decisions have been reasonable and have provided the public with a high degree of protection. The evaluation found the board's decisions to dismiss or take action have been appropriate given the nurses' violations, and complaint outcomes have adequately protected the public. The report concludes the board has used the most serious action, suspension or revocation, in situations where the public has been at risk. And I quote, "If anything, the board has tended to err on the side of public safety in disciplining nurses," end quote. The evaluators also looked at the rate of dismissals and noted that while there are problems on how dismissals are reported, they found the board staff are diligent in assuring they have the whole picture when they evaluate complaints, and they use their expertise as nurses to help them understand the circumstances surrounding the complaints and to assist them in conducting discipline conference interviews. The report also found the board seeks to dismiss cases where discipline against a nurse would serve no public protection purpose, such as in the cases of human error and when circumstances leading to an incident fall outside the control of the nurse. I especially appreciate the evaluator's validation of the staff's expertise and diligence. The report concludes that the board has taken too long to resolve some complaints when the public could be at risk, and the board agrees with this finding. This is an area of concern for the board and is also a part of the report the board staff are most appreciative of the analysis. Board members and staff went through a Kaizen experience in 2013 to identify ways to reduce the complaint resolution cycle to an average of 130 days. However, the evaluators made a much finer analysis, looking at timeliness related to type of actions and those which were not resolved within the statutory guideline of 1 year. While the board has steadily decreased the percentage taking over a year to resolve, in 2014, 15% of the cases took longer than a year to resolve. We find the analysis to be very helpful with the greater detail than just looking at an average, and will consider conducting a root cause analysis for those cases that fall outside the reasonable time frame to determine improvements. The board concludes that the board's process for resolving complaints is complex, partly because it is based on a philosophy surrounding each complaint to be considered individually and in a manner that safeguards nurses' due process rights. The evaluators found that while the board has been highly consistent in resolving complaints alleging drug diversion, they found practice-related complaints were sometimes resolved inconsistently, and the board has not adopted or implemented clear policies, guidelines, or rules to help board members in resolving complaints. They did further conclude that despite inconsistency in practice-related complaints, they did not find any case where the action imposed by the board was grossly disproportionate, that is, too lenient or too strict for the act committed. The board is committed to ensuring due process rights of licensees are upheld in all its processes. This compels the board to consider cases on an individual basis, evaluating the unique circumstances of each case, while ensuring similarly situated licensees are treated in a similar manner. Guidelines for case outcomes can be a useful tool to provide consistency among similar cases. The challenge is to develop guidelines that provide sufficient detail to give clear and unambiguous direction, that is helpful, yet are broad and inclusive enough to capture all relevant aggravating and mitigating circumstances.
Excuse me, Ms. Brecken, mm-hmm. We have a question from a member, Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Oh, I guess she'll wait till you're finished.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The evaluators found that the board has done little to help ensure that nurses understand the process. The evaluators did find that while the nurses are treated respectfully throughout the process, it can be intimidating. and I think that is something that Representative Hamilton alluded to. The board acknowledges that the process is intimidating. I appreciate the recognition, though, that nurses are treated respectfully, as that is always the goal of board members and staff. The notice of conference is not anything like sending an invitation to come in for a little chat. The documents are written in legalese, and while the boilerplate is written in conjunction with the Office of the Attorney General's Office and other health aid licensing boards with the intent of due process and consistency, the board does recognize the need for and the governor's call for documents to be written in plain language. The board has implemented this philosophy in many application forms and is committed to continuing to do so in all written documentation. The evaluators acknowledge that complaint resolution information is on the board's website, but it is hard to find. I did go to the website for a quick review and found the material under the public tab because we want members of the public to know how to file a complaint and what will happen to that complaint. It is not likely a nurse who is subject to discipline or who is the subject of a complaint would look there. We are committed to reviewing our website, including users of the website, to enhance the experience and access to information. In fact, we did, a while ago, have a review by the Citizens Advocacy Center, which is an organization dedicated to educating public members of boards. And we implemented many of their recommendations, including, ironically, putting the complaint resolution information under the public tab rather than under the nurses tab. But we will continue to look at our website from that nurse user perspective. Chapter 3 in the report addresses the Health Professional Services Program in relationship to the Board of Nursing. The Board of Nursing has been a supporter and participant of HPSP since its inception in 1994. In fact, it was the Board of Nursing and the Board of Medical Practice that worked with stakeholders in the legislature to authorize this program. Nurses are the greatest participants in the program, and as was addressed by Representative Murphy, it's because they're the largest healthcare practitioner group. Last year, based on participation of nurses in the program, the board spent nearly $450,000 to fund this program. Nurses in the program successfully complete the program at a rate lower than other health professionals. That rate is about 48% compared to 59% for other professionals. The Board of Nursing is committed to collaborating with HPSP to arrive at effective and efficient reporting decisions that do support public protection. The evaluators have provided data and analysis that is still a bit overwhelming. I have read the report more times than I care to count. However, the board members and full staff have yet to have the opportunity to study all that is in here in detail. But I assure you they are eager to do a comprehensive review of not only the data, but the 23 recommendations that are in the report and listed separately on pages 91 and 92. I have not purposely addressed those recommendations as the board members have not had that opportunity. They have scheduled their first meeting, as Ms. Hugginson told you, for April 3rd to do a begin their review of the report. As I said at the beginning, some of the issues and recommendations are validations of considerations the board has already identified, and thank you for that. It will be important for the board members and staff to carefully consider the recommendations for feasibility, return on investment, and resources, and strategically plan for implementation. This evaluation was a challenging process. The evaluators were with us for many months. They requested a tremendous amount of data, asked even more questions, attended meetings and conferences, and posed some strategic placement sometimes. They were professional and ethical. And I'm sorry that Mr. Noble left because I wanted to share with him, in fact, they are so ethical that we had a potluck one of the days they were in the office and they ate their own lunch so as not to be influenced at all by our cooking, apparently. I think that's a bit of a stretch, and I think I'd like to talk with him about that. It's been quite a journey. Given all that, we are pleased to have the report. It will facilitate the board to develop a roadmap for process improvement. The board members are committed to public protection. It is a privilege to work with them. They volunteer many hours attending meetings and hearings. In fact, nearly 2,000 hours were spent by board members last year. And as the report says, that does not count, that does not include the countless number of hours that they prepare for board meetings. I'm also privileged to work with a staff that shares that commitment. Thank you for listening today and supporting the board in its work. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Brecken. We do have a question by Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Brecken. It is really comforting, I think, to have this report and what you referred to, the series of articles from the STRIB. And I understand I had a little chance to talk with the auditor personnel, too, before. And I do want to just kind of say clearly that, you know, a lot of allegations were made in that newspaper series. It made us all very nervous. And I think that the board really has been vindicated in large part because the auditor was able to look at information that was not public, and that they explained that to me. And I, you know, we all have a great deal of respect for the OLA, and that's very comforting, I think, to us as legislators to know that, indeed, you know, we're not so far off track. But that said, you know, I did want to visit with you this issue about the time lag that you heard me ask. I really want you to respond to that because, you know, that is still a deep concern, and they really did validate that concern. And, you know, I'm hearing that there's maybe the board is doing more to move more quickly, but please reassure me that that big concern that we all had last year is being addressed, because the idea that impaired nurses are, you know, are coming to the attention of the board either from being kicked out of HPSP or some other way and then presenting a public safety hazard and not being immediately addressed, that is still a big concern.
Ms. Bracken. Bracken, sorry.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling. What I appreciated the most about the report was the detail of the analysis, because as I said, the board has for a long time focused on its complaint cycle resolution time. And we have been reducing that time. But we've been looking at an average. We have not been looking at it at the more in-depth level of cases which are dismissed, cases which are, you know, get action. And the auditor's analysis really helps us to focus much more on more detail and to get more granular about that analysis. So we really can focus on those, if from a total perspective, not just reducing the average length of time. Although I have to say, I'm proud that we have been reducing that amount of time. We've done it in some other ways. The board now meets monthly instead of every other month, so obviously that shortens the time between when there is an agreement reached and when the board ratifies that agreement. You and I talked about the temp suspensions, and we've talked about that for some time, and I really do appreciate the time and effort that you've put into, you know, giving the board greater authority to do that. The board, up until 2014, did not use temporary suspension very readily. We had historically or traditionally been advised by the Attorney General's office that the standard was high, that to show imminent serious risk of harm and to have sufficient evidence to be able to go to a hearing within 30 days. And so I would tell you that I recognize that the board did not use temp suspension, you know, nearly as readily as it might have. At the same time, the board has increased the amount of time, or excuse me, the number of times that it is doing temp suspensions. I'm sorry, I don't know the number since July of 2015. I will certainly get that to you. Because I know the auditor's report includes it for 2014, and as they shared with you, the number of times increased twofold over the previous 5 years. The idea of the statute currently requires the board to resolve a complaint within 1 year or longer if it's needed, you know, dependent upon the situation. We have, I think, in the past, and I know, I mean, while we've reduced the number of cases that are over a year for resolution, we still had, as I said, 15% of those in 2014 that took longer than a year. And there's always a variety of reasons for that, whether it's, you know, and I won't go into those, because what I think is important for us is that the board needs to do a greater job, and I would call it a root cause analysis, you know, for want of a better term, of looking at those cases that do take longer than they should or longer than the expected standard that the board has set for them, to learn why. What is it? And given those whys, what can the board do then to resolve those particular things? So it is something that the board has considered to be important. It's something I consider to be important. Staff knows that. I think sometimes, you know, they're a little taken aback when I say, tell me what went on, you know, why did it take this long? There's, as the auditors pointed out, there's a variety of reasons, but you know, but we need to look at what they are and come up with solutions for them.
Thank you, Ms. Brecken. Representative Liebling?
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Brecken. And you know, the issue about the length of time and all that you just focused on is that's all very important, and there are some recommendations, and good, I'm glad you're going to tighten that up. But it's still, I think, of great concern to the public. We want to know that when somebody comes to your attention for having flunked out of HPSP, for example, that somebody's eyes are on that case immediately to assess whether there is an immediate public health concern or safety concern. And the idea that, I don't have a good sense right now of whether that's happening. Now, the numbers that get immediate suspension, that's the fact that that's increasing tells me that there's more of an attempt to use that tool. But I think the real key issue is that somebody needs to assess that immediately. And the idea that for whatever reason nobody's maybe assessing it for a few months while a potentially addicted or otherwise impaired nurse is out there practicing, that's really serious. So I hope you can assure the public that somebody's eyes are on these almost as soon as they come to you. And that should include, I think, cases that come from elsewhere, even if you can't get to them to investigate them. And I think Representative Hamilton was addressing this kind of from the other side, too. If there's nothing going on, you know, if it's a complaint that's really minor, why in the world should we leave a nurse on the hook worried or, you know, we want to... But especially if it's something that could cause harm to the public, I just want to know. I think the whole public wants to know that those are being considered right away.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, to my right is Renee Cronquist. Renee Cronquist is Director for Practice and Policy at the Board, and I'm assuming that she came up to the table because she has something to say about that.
Ms. Cronquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Liebling, to specifically answer that question, let me just say absolutely yes. Even our support staff, there's a couple of individuals who are the very, very, very first point of contact when a complaint comes in from any source. They literally are put in a separate place so they don't get lost or mixed in with anything else, and literally those support staff will be the very first ones to take a look at it. And they can recognize when something might have some elements of diversion, or something else that's just very significant right on its face. They will immediately bring that to our discipline coordinator, who will review it immediately. In her absence, it would be brought to me. And literally, I mean, I don't want to make it sound silly, but they'll put it on my chair so it doesn't get lost. We were recently in a joint board staff HPSP meeting, and that question came up about, you know, when a report comes from the HPSP to a board, what do you do with it? And I can tell you, even though the boards vary in their processes, each and every board in attendance said, we look at it immediately. Because you need to make an immediate determination about the level of severity, the risk. We do have a triage or a prioritization system, a coding system for our complaints, and we do feel a message that came through from OLA was that coding system needs refinement. There's sort of too many things that get put in that middle category. The really severe ones, significant ones, they get a lot of priority. Some of those ones at a little bit lower, you know, that takes maybe a little bit longer. It's that middle category we really want to refine. The other thing that I would add is, in addition to suspending a license or a temporary suspension, the board does have other tools at its disposal. And one of them that we've used quite often is something called a stipulation to cease practice. That's an agreement between the nurse and the board where the nurse agrees that they will not practice while the board continues its investigation. In many respects, that's a better tool than attempt suspension because the nurse has agreed to it. It doesn't require a contested case hearing. On the downside, it requires the agreement of the nurse, and sometimes they're not responsive. So at times, we might try to use that tool and then go to the temp suspension. The stipulation to cease practice is a public document, so an employer or a potential employer would know that action has been taken. And I think the only other point I wanted to make is, and please don't misunderstand me, I am not making excuses for a time lag. To the contrary, we're very aware of that. It is important to understand, though, that a discharge from HPSP is a very broad category. In some cases, it's that HPSP has received a third-party referral, and the nurse or whatever licensee just chose not to cooperate, not to respond in any way, shape, or form. So that's going to come to the board the same as any other complaint. We're starting from square one. Or it can be that, yes, the individual was in the program, they were monitored, so we have quite a bit of detail from the HPSP about that monitoring experience and about their history, but the noncompliance might be, while important because it's noncompliance with that monitoring plan, it might be something that doesn't pose such a risk to the public, such as dilute screens or late screens. That screening process is so important. It's how we have that assurance that they're safe to practice, but we don't, until we get into it, we don't know, well, why did you miss those screens? In other cases, the nurse was ordered to the HPSP. And in that order, the board and the nurse agreed to terms. Here's what we're going to do if you get discharged from the HPSP. And it is a binding agreement. And so we need to go through different processes. We don't have the option in that case. We're going to attempt to suspend you. We do have tools in that agreement to act quickly. The other piece is it is important to know that when a nurse doesn't have a current license, he or she can't practice. And that is another thing that we look at, that, yep, that complaint came in and it's serious and we absolutely want to act on it so they don't take a geographical cure and go somewhere else. But when they don't have that current registration, they're not authorized to practice in Minnesota. So in that regard, again, we want to act quickly, but they're not posing that risk to the public. And that sometimes isn't identified in the report.
Thank you, Ms. Conkress. We have just 3 minutes left to our meeting, and we have a question from Representative Purcells, and then I believe there's someone from the audience that has a question as well. So, Representative Liebling, you had the floor. Is that all right?
I'm fine. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. Very good. Mrs. Conkress, thank you very much. It's Cronquist.
Cronquist.
Okay. All right. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Becken, in your... You're talking about, and you brought up a statement. I don't know if I have it exact, but I paraphrase it pretty good here. Circumstances resulting in the incident are beyond the control of the nurse. What? Give me an example of that.
Ms. Bracken, briefly, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, those might be instances in which policies within an institution are unclear as to what the nurse should be doing in a given situation. It might be situations in which there may be... I'll give you an example that was in the report. There was an instance in which in a long-term care facility, residents were routinely allowed to use the emergency exit door to go out for whatever reason, smoke, whatever. So nurses didn't always respond to that alarm because it was accepted policy within the facility. In this particular situation, the individual went out and did not return, and in fact died. Well, that was a situation that was really outside of the nurse's control, because it was such an accepted and routine practice within the facility that they didn't run to check the alarm every time. And in fact, in this instance, the nurse was busy with another patient when the alarm sounded, and so did not go and check on it. So that would be a very extreme example in which there was harm that occurred, but it really was not within the nurse's control because of the accepted policy or practice within the facility.
If I may, just real quick, I want to make a point about some incidents up in my neck of the woods up north, and it involved violence in the workplace where nurses were working, and I didn't know if this is a pretty real deal, and there can be some significant trauma bordering on, if not PTSD issues, and that can lead to, you know, spiraling down alcohol, drug, whatever you use. So I didn't know where you were going, but I wanted to mention that. Thank you.
Members, having 2:30 arrived, we have to adjourn. There's another meeting right here. Mr. Heller from the audience, I know you have a question, but I think it might be for the OLA, so maybe we can take that offline. But unfortunately, we are out of time. We have to vacate the premises for another meeting. So, members, we are adjourned. Thank you, testifiers,
for your Mr. Chair and
commitment to the good cause. This meeting is adjourned.